Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be covering a large body of Scripture today. When I tell you, Exodus 7 through 11, you're going to say, how can we cover that in 30 minutes? That's a good question. It is a literary unit. It's the 10 plagues. And there is a stylistic repetition. And that repetition of form is going to enable us to cover this material in our block of time together. This repetition, though there is some variety, in my opinion, expresses completely from an eyewitness account what happened. Many little details here and there. There is some theological questions about the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, which when you look at the rest of the scope of Scripture, we have difficulty and free will and sovereignty. But folks, when you look at the Bible, God's in control of His universe for the purpose of redemption. And sometimes I don't think He violates an individual's free will. But the truth is, if He violated one person's free will for a goal of reaching the whole world, who are we to say that God has acted inappropriately? Who are we to say God acted inappropriately anyway? That's basically what Romans 9 is all about, which quotes from this passage. Now, the 10 plagues have a theological purpose. They, in my opinion, are redemptive. They are evangelistic. There's been many different commentators' speculation about the time involved. Obviously, God took a period of time that's not spelled out in the Scriptures. It can be anywhere from 6 months to 18 months because there is some yearly cycles involved in these plagues. Now, some say the plagues came at the natural time of the appropriate season, and others say they came at the exact opposite of the appropriate season, but there's anywhere from 1 year involved to a year and a half. God could have come in and struck all of them blind, taken the children out in 24 hours, but I think He's working with the faith of the Egyptians, the faith of the Hebrews, for the purpose of the redemption of the whole world. I think it's just another way of talking about Genesis chapter 12. The call of Abraham was not only for Abraham and his children, but for the whole world. Now let's look at it if we could. By the way, I want to mention one more thing. There is a real similarity between these plagues and the way that John uses them in Revelation 8 and Revelation 16. But John has totally taken them out of their historical context and is using them in a different way. So really the Bible doesn't make a big deal out of these 10 plagues, a big deal out of the Exodus, but doesn't develop the theme of the plagues like we would have thought. They're mentioned in Psalms 105, which basically is a description of the Exodus, but that's about the only place else we find them. So let's begin in chapter 7, verse 1. And I want to mention to you, here's an obvious example that the chapter divisions of your Bible are wrong. It wasn't done till the Middle Ages, the A.D. Middle Ages, and it was done by finite people. It has nothing to do with the inspiration of the text. Because really, the literary block of material begins in chapter 6, verse 28, and then through chapter 7, verse 7 is really an isolated introduction before the 10 plagues. I'm going to deal with chapter 7, 1 through 7, just to give you a brief background, but it is separate. Then the Lord said to Moses, "See, I make you as God to Pharaoh." And what does this mean? Well, it seems to me there's two real good possibilities. Number one, you're going to be an authority figure for Pharaoh. And number two, Pharaoh thinks of himself as a god. I'm going to make you equal in his sight. Now, that seems to be one of the two of those is the thrust here. Notice it mentions that you are to speak all I command you. You and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh to let the sons of Israel go out of his land. And that's going to be a pattern going to be all the way through here. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And I will multiply signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. Now, I want to say again, every time this hardening is mentioned back in chapter 4, verse 21. If you look at this in an analytical outline way, you'll see that about five times it says God hardens Pharaoh's heart. About four times it says Pharaoh hardens his own heart. And one time it says Pharaoh's heart was hardened without saying that who did it. Now, folks, notice that the heart is hardened in connection with the signs. That's very important. This is not some arbitrary act of God. I think it's an act of God's foreknowledge and personally, and not totally violating Pharaoh's choice. This has nothing to do with the salvation of Pharaoh as much as it has to do with God trying to bring Pharaoh's people, the Hebrews, and the whole world to know Him. Now, I want to show you that pattern. And the way I'm going to deal with this chapter, these several chapters, is to show you the pattern as we go through it. Notice number one, it says there's an evangelistic purpose for Pharaoh himself, chapter 8, verse 10. And there's an evangelistic thrust for the magicians, chapter 8, verse 19. Notice again, there's an evangelistic thrust to all of Egypt, chapter 9, verses 14 and 15. And there is a thrust for all the world to know Yahweh, chapter 9, verse 16. We can see the effect of this very clearly, that some of Pharaoh's servants did believe, chapter 9, verse 20, and particularly chapter 11, verse 3. Pharaoh is even going to say, pray for me. And I think it's a sincere idea. God is working for redemptive purposes through here. And so I don't think we ought to see this as a violation of man's free will, because I want to tell you, in my understanding, all of God's dealing with man is God's unconditional initiating love and man's conditional faith and repentance response. And this does not violate that, in my opinion. It's a very similar to the problem with Judas. But it's an isolated problem, not a one to build a heavy, overarching universal theology on. Now notice it mentions here, and Pharaoh will not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my host. Now usually the word host refers to the angelic army, or a military term for God as the commander of the heavenly armies. But here it simply means a large number of people, the people of God. How big they were, we don't know. We've thought about that. Is there 10,000 or is there 3 million? I'm not sure. From the land of Egypt by great judgments. Now the word judgments here, is this on the sin of the Egyptians? Well, to some extent, but primarily these signs and wonders are going to be against Egyptian deities. And I want to tell you, what we see here is Moses confronting head-on the theological system of Egypt. Pharaoh, son of the sun god Ra, all these animals were Egyptian deities. The Nile was an Egyptian deity. A darkness, the sun, was a major Egyptian deity. God's confronting the theological system of the Egyptians to show the power, the preeminence of Yahweh. That's the purpose of these plagues, not some arbitrary cat-and-mouse game. No, no, no. Notice again it says in verse 7, and Moses was 80 years old and Aaron was 83. Now, from Acts chapter 7, verse 23, and from other places in the Pentateuch, it seems that we could divide Moses' life into three sections of 40 years. Stayed in Pharaoh's house and was trained in all the knowledge of his day, 40 years. Killed the Egyptian and had to live in the desert, the very desert that he would lead the children of Israel into, 40 years. And then 40 years of the delivery, wilderness wandering, before he died on Mount Nebo. And that's why I think the 120 years, kind of an idealistic term of life in this period of the Old Testament. And it says that his natural vigor was not abated when God took him home on Mount Nebo. Now in verse 8, which starts the plague. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh says to you, work a miracle. Now Pharaoh wanted a sign. Pharaoh's saying, who is this God anyway? You might want to go back to chapter 4, verse 3. The first sign he's going to do is his staff turning into a serpent. Well, that was originally a sign that God had given to Moses for Moses to show the people. Now, some say Pharaoh may have heard what Moses did to convince the Hebrews he was from God, and his magicians had been already prepared to duplicate this sign. And there is some snake-charming techniques we hear about where if you grab a snake behind his head in a certain way, he becomes rigid because of the pressure point, and if you throw him down, it shocks him in. Friends, I want to tell you here, and I must admit I don't know. There is a part of me that sees in these plagues natural phenomenon, but with supernatural timing, supernatural intensity, and a supernatural selectivity. It happens to the Egyptians, doesn't happen to the Hebrews in the land of Goshen. So I think God is using natural means. He'll use the east wind, he'll use the west wind, he'll use frogs, common in the Nile, and on and on. But on the other half of me says, there is a confrontation of the powers of God and the powers of darkness. That the magicians are not just tricksters using natural means, knowing secrets, how to hold snake's head. But that there is the supernatural demonic power, magic power. And we know that Egypt was strongly into magic. We found the magic papyri in Egypt. I tend to want to say it's the power of the demonic versus the power of Yahweh. For I tell you, I see that throughout the Bible, and I believe in a supernatural interpenetrating the natural. Now notice, if you would, But he throws it down, and it becomes a serpent. Now, the word serpent here is tannin. It's usually a word that means a reptile, possible crocodile. But because it's used in chapter 7, 9, 10, and 12, but then in chapter 7, verse 15, it's the regular word for serpent, and that's what's used back in chapter 4, verse 3. And so here they're obviously synonyms, and I think a serpent. Now, magicians, who are those? Well, from 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 8, we have the rabbinical tradition of their names, and there were two of them, though we're not certain of that. Now, these magicians, we think because of the Egyptian consonants and an Assyrian word built on that, that this word magicians may mean chief of the priests. For we know this this priestly class was also very much into magic and soothsaying and astrology and all that, both in Egypt and in Babylon. And they did the same with their secret arts. Whether it's trickery or demonic power, I'm not sure. I tend to think it's demonic power. This same thing is going to happen again in verse 22 and in chapter 8, verse 7. But there'll come a place, primarily the gnats, that the Egyptians can't duplicate it. Now, I get so tickled with this. All that the Egyptians need were their wise men turning more water into blood and making more frogs come out of the dust. They ain't no answer. They need to take them away, not bring more. So what help is that, right? Now, this idea of throwing down the staff and then they did it. You know, snake charming is mentioned several times in the Old Testament. It's mentioned in Psalms 58:5. Mentioned Ecclesiastes 10:11, mentioned in Jeremiah 8:17. So there was some snake charming in their culture. Moses' staff ate the other ones. Well, now look at verse 14. We have Pharaoh's going to refuse. His heart's going to be hardened. And he's going to go out as he goes out to the water. Now, I really think that because of chapter 8, verse 20, and chapter 9, verse 13, that Pharaoh is going out to the water every day. Now, why is that? Well, the Nile is one of the major gods of Egypt, and he is going out every day for either a ritual bath or some kind of sacrifice or prayer at the water's edge, in Hebrew called the lip of the river. Now, that's where Moses and Aaron are told to meet him several times in the act of worship, seems to be, in the act of his ritual, which has very great symbolic meaning. Now, he went out there to meet him, and he's going to tell him about the serpent, but he wouldn't believe that. He said, "Let my people go." He wouldn't believe that. So right there, I think in the act of worshiping the Nile, Moses is going to say, "I'm going to show you that my God's more powerful than yours. I'm going to turn this God of yours, this life-giving source, all of Egypt depends on the Nile for its overflowing fertility every year. God's going to strike that Nile, going to turn it to blood." Now you say, "Bob, is that literal blood?" I don't know. We're going to know the fish are going to die, and the water is going to stink, and the Egyptians don't want to drink it. Now, is it the water that caused the fish to die? Did the fish dying cause the water to stink? Is it the color red? I don't think it turned to literal blood. I do believe it turned red. Now, if you're into natural means here, we know that one of the upper sources of the Nile goes through Ethiopia. There is a time of the year when the red clay is picked up and turns the Nile red. Is that what it's talking about? If it is, it's supernatural timing, not the element itself. But is there anything else? Well, we know of the red tide in salt water. Maybe there is a natural means here, but it's supernatural in its intent and timing and purpose here. I can't say more than that. I don't know. All the water in Egypt turned to red, blood, whatever you want to say. Now, the people, later on it says, they went down to the water and had to dig holes to get fresh water. So obviously the water didn't stay red over all the land. They could go to the river and dig into the sand and get some water they could drink. So there is some difficulty understanding everything about this that's involved. In chapter 8, we begin with the frog. There are some Egyptian deities, one male, one female, that have the frog as a form. I think he, again, is attacking it. Is this the natural time when frogs come out, the time of the overflow of the Nile? Maybe so. Is it exactly the opposite time where frogs weren't in the land? I don't know. But folks, there were more frogs here than they ever saw before. There are frogs in their beds, frogs in their ovens, frogs in their ears, frogs coming out their nose. Boy, Pharaoh says enough of these frogs. So down here, he calls Moses and Aaron, and he says, "Entreat the Lord." This is the first time in chapter 8, verse 8, that he did that. And he said, "I will let your people go." Now, I want to show you a pattern here. Apparently, Pharaoh, there's some oriental bargaining going on in these chapters. Moses says this. Pharaoh says, "Well, I'll give you this much." Moses says, "No, I want this." And so you got to see it in light of oriental bargaining. Some of the compromises of Pharaoh are seen here in chapter 8, verse 8, where Pharaoh says, "Pray for me. Get rid of these frogs." Again, we see it in chapter 8, verse 25, where he says, you can go, but you got to sacrifice in the land. Moses says no. In chapter 8, verse 28, he says, you can go, but not too far away. Moses says no. In chapter 9, verses 27 and 28, he just says, get out of here. But then again, in chapter 10, verse 8, he says, only the men can go. In chapter 10, verse 16 through 20, and particularly chapter 10, verse 24, he says, you've got to leave your herds. Now, you see the kind of bargaining going to be going on through here. Notice in verse 9, Moses says to Pharaoh, the honor is yours, tell me. Now, this seems to be an idiom that we're not sure of. Some say, particularly one of my favorite Old Testament commentators, he's a little bit liberal for me, but I do like the detail with which he writes, is Childs. I believe he teaches at Princeton or Union, I've forgotten which. I'll give you the advantage, set the time. Maybe that's a good idiom for this. But anyway, it's him setting the time when the frogs will be gone. Why? To show him it's God, not just the natural frog death. And the same kind of you set the time is found in chapter 9, verse 5. And so another supernatural element, they set the time when they came, set the time when they left. Notice in verse 10, it's spelled out, that you may know there is no one like Yahweh, our Elohim. Now there's the deal. These signs are for the purpose of evangelism. I hope you see that. It changes this whole thrust. Notice now in verse 16, we have gnats. Now, we don't know what this Hebrew word is. It only occurs here and in Psalms 105:31 where it's mentioned. It's obviously a flying insect. What kind of insect? Fleas, gadflies, mosquitoes? I don't know. Some kind of flying insect. Whether they were used to or not used to, I'm not sure. Now, the Jerusalem Targum says wild beast. And that's kind of a bad translation. It just is obviously an idiom in Egyptian that doesn't mean wild beast. It means some kind of flying insects. Now, the Egyptians tried in verse 18. They couldn't duplicate it. Notice the Egyptians come to believe God did it, verse 19, and say, it's the finger of God, which is an idiom for it's the power of God. We can't duplicate it. God's stronger than we are, stronger than our gods. The Egyptians, magicians are even being brought to a place of knowing Yahweh is powerful and hopefully coming to trust Him. Now, notice, if you would, the finger of God, of course, is an anthropomorphic phrase. God doesn't have a finger. God doesn't have a human body. But it's a way of speaking of the power of God active in our world. Now, notice again in verse 20, Pharaoh goes to the Nile. Moses and Aaron meet him there. Notice in verse 22, a new element is added to these things. It's going to happen to the Egyptians, but it's not going to happen to the land of Goshen, the Hebrews. And here again is another supernatural element. It's going to happen all around the Nile Delta, but not in the Nile Delta. Now, if there's going to be frogs and insects, they ought to be in the Nile Delta. That's where all the water is, all the different branches. But no, it's going to be on the Egyptians and not on the Hebrews. Now that happens several times through here. 9:4, 9:26, 10:23, 11:7 is this supernatural selectivity of locality. Notice again it says, I, the Lord, am in the midst of the land. Notice God is with His people. That's a theme throughout the Bible. Starts in Genesis, God with his creation. It's with the Exodus, God with His people. Emmanuel, God with us. The book of the Revelation closes with God with His people. That's the thrust. God wants to be with His people. Now in verse 25, we have the beginning of another bargaining session. Moses says, let my people go. He says, well, all right, you can go, but just sacrifice here in the land. Don't go out of the land. Moses said, we can't. Our sacrifice would be an abomination to the Egyptians. Now, we know from some historical records that the Egyptians did offer mostly vegetable sacrifices, but at times they would put some meat sacrifices on by the side of their sacrifices. Now, we have two different Jewish sources. One of the Targums says that refer to sacrificing cattle, and the Jerusalem Targum says it refers to sacrificing sheep. I'm not sure exactly what it meant, but the Egyptians don't sacrifice animals like the Hebrews did. Now, this three-day journey down in verse 27 is interesting. It's first mentioned in chapter 3, verse 18, three-day journey. It seems that that is just a bold-faced lie, because Moses wasn't planning on going 3 days and coming back. Mount Sinai is farther than 3 days away if the southern Sinai Peninsula locality, Jebel Musa, is correct. But some say it's a cultural idiom. And I think that's real possible because over in chapter 10, verse 23, the word three is going to be used as an idiom. So I really think it's an idiom for let us go for an extended period of time. Others say that Moses was just trying to trick Pharaoh, but I really don't see that here. Notice at verse 20 it says, make supplication for me. Here again, Pharaoh's getting the idea that Yahweh is a powerful God. Verse 29 says, don't let Pharaoh deal deceitfully with you. He has done that several times. Said, okay, get this plague off and I'll do it. And then he changes his mind. He's going to do that in verse 15. He's going to do that in verse 32. Now in chapter 9, notice another set of plagues come. And notice in verse 5, the Lord set a definite time. Again, the supernatural timing. God's trying to show it's not by accident when the plagues come. It's not by accident when the plagues leave. So you can't say it's just natural phenomenon. No, it's supernatural timing, even if it is natural things that God's using with a special intensity and selectivity of locality. Notice that the cattle is going to die here in this plague. But yet we've got cattle mentioned again in verse 6. So obviously all the cattle didn't die, or the word here for cattle means only a certain kind of animals. Maybe it means the domestic cattle here and the sheep here or whatever. So I don't think it's a contradiction. It's just different kinds of domestic animals, or all the animals didn't die. You said it says all the animals die. The word, the Bible uses the word all many times to mean the majority, the most, and not in our sense of literally every last animal. So be careful of being too dogmatic here. Notice in verse 14 how significant. By the way, verse 13, they're told to rise up early and meet Pharaoh. Implication is at the Nile. Now again in verse 14, so that you may know there is no one like me in all the earth. Here is the universal implication of the evangelistic purpose of the plagues. The whole world will hear about this and they'll know that Yahweh, He is God. Now at this point, it's probably He is a stronger God, but it's going to move into the only God. So verses 14, look at verse 16. Even more, in order to proclaim my name through all the earth. Man, that's strong. Now hail's going to come in verse 18. We're not sure how often hail falls in Egypt, but we think it's a rarity. Here it's going to be some kind of hail. But notice this is the first plague. They're going to say, if you'll take your cattle in the shed, they'll be saved. Some of the servants are going to believe in verse 20, and so it's a possibility of growing faith. Just like the Hebrews had to believe God and put the blood on the door, here the Egyptians have a chance to save their cattle, and some of the servants did. Fire came down from heaven, verse 23, obviously lightning. Spread out my hands, Moses says in verse 29, the normal biblical way for Jewish prayer is hands lifted and eyes lifted, right? We get our bowing our head and closing our eyes from the parable of the Pharisee in the center. I wonder if we don't beat our breasts, too. Notice down in verse 31 and 32 is a kind of a parenthesis that gives the details of why, if all the things were destroyed by hail, what was left for the locusts? Well, a different kind of crop was left. That's what it is. Now in verse 10, chapter 10, verse 2, it says that you may tell your sons about this, your grandsons. This is a characteristic theme of the Pentateuch. We see it in Deuteronomy 4, verse 9, Deuteronomy 6, 20 through 25, Deuteronomy 11, 19, and Deuteronomy 32, 46. That they may know that I am the Lord. And then the rest in chapter 10, notice the locust came. And it's again the intensity factor. Notice an east wind is going to bring them and a west wind is going to take them away. God using natural means along with supernatural timing. Notice in verse 8 it says, go, serve the Lord. But then in verse 11, he's going to limit it to the men only. Now the Red Sea is mentioned down here in verse 19. That implies a large body of water. Some say it's close to the Mediterranean Sea, kind of a marshy area. Some say it's in the middle of the Suez Canal today, a bitter salt lakes. And some say, no, it's the northern end of the Red Sea. The literal term is the Sea of Reed, Yam Suth. It can refer to either one of those three localities. The Bible's just not real concerned about the locality of the route of the Exodus or the locality of Mount Sinai. It's concerned with the covenant promises of God and the Promised Land. Notice in verse 21, it's the plague of darkness. It was a darkness that could be felt. Many of us think it's one of these terrible sandstorms. Here's the sun god Ra of Egypt facing the power of Yahweh, and God cuts the light of the sun off. I think it's a very sandstorm that came. That's why I think it says felt. Notice in verse 23 is the word 3 days used as an idiom, and you can see what I've talked about back in chapter 8, verse 28. Notice he says, let your flock stay. The Egyptian herds have been killed. He wanted to get the Hebrew herds. Moses said, no way, Jose. You shall never see your face again. I think it's an overreaction. I think Moses said, fine. But notice the rest of chapter 11, verses 4 through 10, Moses is talking to Pharaoh. One of two things are true. It's an idiom of intensity of the Oriental debate. Or chapter 11 is out of chronological order. I don't know which it is. Does it make any difference? I don't think, really. Now, notice again, it says, ask all the Egyptian neighbors for gold and silver. This verse is mentioned back in chapter 3, verses 21 and 22. It's going to be literally accomplished in chapter 12, verse 35. It's mentioned in Psalms 105, 37. Now, the word ask in King James is translated borrow. And there is an etymological possibility. The word borrow is true. It's used that way in Judges 8, 24 and 1 Samuel 1, 27. But it's meant to be asked so as to return. And there's some other use of this term in Exodus 22:13 and 2 Kings 4:3 and 6:5, where it means just give me. And that's the thrust here. It's not duplicity. It's just a different use of the Hebrew word. Notice here comes the last plague. No human instrumentality. It's God himself in the person of the death angel. No, the death angel is not evil. It's a servant of God. The firstborn. The firstborn was very important. First of all, the firstborn of Pharaoh was considered to be a god too, another judgment on the Egyptian gods. But the firstborn inherited the rights of the land, the firstborn took care of the parents, and the firstborn was the legal guardian of the other children. So all of Egyptian society was disrupted. It is my personal belief that God took these young Egyptians, and hopefully they were under the age of knowing what their parents were doing, and I think they're in heaven. So it was great sorrow for the Egyptian parents, but I think it was salvation for these kids. Notice the selectivity. In the land of Goshen, verse 7, not even a dog will bark, which means it'll be totally quiet. Not all the wailing of these parents losing their children. I personally believe it's children still at home, not married firstborn kids that were gone. It was a terrible, terrible night. The Hebrews had to act by faith and get the lamb's blood and fix it a certain way and put the blood on there. Even in the land of Goshen, the death angel came. And any house, even in the land of Goshen, that didn't have this faith blood put on the door, the death angel would visit. So here, the Hebrews have to act by faith. And this is the last plague, the great plague, that'll be discussed as the Passover in chapters 12 and the firstborn dedicated to God in chapter 13. Here I think we see the power of God for his major purpose. I think, again, you've got to see the 10 plagues in light of the evangelistic purpose of God and not in God playing favorites. God did choose Abraham and his children to choose the world, Genesis 12, 3. It's not God playing favorites. It's God picking one man to pick a nation, to be a kingdom of priests, to pick the whole world. And here I see it as God's mercy, not just God's judgment. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.